So, welcome everybody. We're going to talk about DDoS analysis and mediation at the infrastructure level. I'm going to take kind of an ISP telco approach of the DDoS problem. Basically, the talk's going to be about some projects we've been running in the last 6 months to secure our own infrastructure against DDoS, try to secure, so to say, our infrastructure against DDoS attacks. What we've doing, what we've been looking at, the problems we've been running into. You're also going to see, you know, why we run these problems, why we came to the point, and had to get back to the router vendor, checking the hardware issues, operating system issues on the box, getting back also like to the point where you have to say, okay, we may use AC as the core, which people are really not used to, or was really out of the best current practices. And one of the things we found out that sometimes you really need to do router forensics. So I'm going to talk a little bit about router forensics. What can you do and how it compares to doing forensics of normal systems, any Unix, Windows-based system, and what the difference are. Because keep in mind, a router is basically an appliance, and you really don't see a lot what's happening inside. Feel free to raise your hand anytime during the talk to ask questions if you have them, and otherwise we'll do a Q&A at the end of the talk. So, you guys probably all know what denial of service attack is. Basically, the goal of denial of service attack is to consume some resources. Being in the lean bandwidth, I mean, that's the attack that's been around for years now. Some new attacks that came out quite recently were more targeting the CPUs of the different systems, memory, eating up memory, not on the end system, but on the intermediate system sitting in the network, like the routers, and also trying to fill up some of the queues. Each box, especially since the bandwidth on most of the backbones shifted like from a few megs 20 years ago to a few gigs, the queue size issue is becoming really a real issue, so to say, on most of the devices. And you're going to see that you also have to look at it when something goes wrong. All the vendors that are selling like high bandwidth gear, being it router, switches, or whatever, usually focus on telling you, yeah, the forwarding performance of a box is like, I can handle 1 million packets a second. The problem is, yeah, they can handle that at line speed, but only on the forwarding path. I mean, the packet enters the box and gets out of the box. The problem is, if somebody attacks the box itself and wants to talk to the box, well, it has to go over software paths. It's not, you know, in an ASIC anymore, going only in hardware queue, some hardware queue to hardware queue. So that's what you're going to see later on, why the attacks are shifting from end systems towards the infrastructure. What you have realized too, and we didn't see it in the beginning, when you do detection and mitigation of attacks, you can really not use the same approach for data centers and infrastructure. For data centers, usually what people tend to do is just put kind of inline device. That means you have many boxes depending on the number of links you got into your data or hosting center, and you have the box sitting inline, like a firewall basically. So there it's quite easy, because at the same time you can get the data you need to fight against the attack, and also kind of try to mitigate the attack there. The problem still is that it's close to the end system, so the closer you are to the end system, the more difficult it is to filter the attack, because on the upstream or the uplinks, the bandwidth is still going to be used, or system may still be attacked. The other approach that's a bad thing, the only way of doing something at the infrastructure level when you have like 50 boxes or 100 boxes sitting in the network, you use something like NetFlow. NetFlow is basically a product that's made into a protocol, or the other way around, depending on how you look at the thing, that does IP accounting. So NetFlow is going to report for every flow it sees through the router. Look, source IP, destination IP, source port, destination port, average size of the packets, and this kind of information. The protocol was developed some years ago with something different in mind than fighting or detecting denial of service attacks, but also billing. Like 4, 5, 6 years ago, a lot of customers started to demand usage-based billing services, like I want a bank link, but I also want to pay what I use. And the only way of doing some kind of accounting was to use something like NetFlow. So most of the billing systems around, you're going to see that ISPs use are still based on NetFlow. And we are using the same technique, first of all to detect attacks, but also to account them. So that's really the first one you're going to see in use. The second one is looking at ACLs and queue counters. So what you have been doing is when you can use NetFlow for any reason, because the box doesn't have NetFlow support, or you may kill the box because NetFlow uses a lot of CPU, you can use ACLs. So we came up with an idea to put permit ACLs for any protocol. That means you do permit TCP, permit UDP, permit IP, and you can count the number of packets going through. So you can at least kind of say, yeah, the attack is more probably a Smurf attack, an ICMP attack, or whatever. So that's kind of the alternative of using not using NetFlow. What we found out quite recently is that by looking at the queue counters of the different cards you have running in the box, the line cards where all your lines are connected, you can also find out, depending on the queues that are being used, kind of what type of attack is going on. Is it more a bandwidth attack? Like, I send a lot of large packets to eat up a bandwidth, or a small kind of packet per second attack, like really small packets, like 64 bytes, but I had a lot of them. So that's the basic way of doing it. The other way is looking at your NMS system. Usually when you have an attack going on, not only on the end system or the routers close to the end system, the CPU load or the interface counts is just going to, you know, went to the maximum and say, yes, something is going wrong, but still you just know why it's exiting the network towards the customer in the access layer. And the easiest way, and probably the cheapest, is just to wait for your customer to call you and tell you, my link is broken, it's not working anymore, it's slow, whatever. And a lot of ISPs are still using that technique. Just wait until the customer calls a knock to say something is wrong. So for small ISPs, you know, that have no one can understand, for the really large ones also, because doing NetFlow when you have like, I don't know, say, let's say UNet, really global network, you have no chance of doing NetFlow. So there's still a lot of ISPs relying on customer calls to get notice of the problem. On the mitigation side, there are also different ways to mitigate the attack. One of them is to use access control lists on the boxes. That means you're going to filter the source of the destination of the attack. What you've seen is that some years ago, everybody was just spoofing the source IP address. So you had like many, many sources, and the only way of filtering was just to filter on the destination, which basically means the guy achieved his goal. The customer has no connectivity anymore. What you're seeing now is that people don't bother anymore just to spoof the source IP address. When you have a botnet running like 100k bots, who cares if the source is spoofed or not? I mean, you have no chance of filtering anyway. So this is one of the changes we have been seeing. And I'm going to come back to the ACLs, how to use them in the core and so on later on. The other approach is CAR. CAR means committed access rates. It's you identify the system or customer or IP range being attacked and you just rate limit the bandwidth to it. That means you just bring the attack down by saying, yeah, the link is not 100 meg anymore, but it's only a 10 meg link. Sometimes it helps, but basically you're just going to protect more your network than the customers. So this is one of the ways of doing it. The other approach that was used in the beginning is just to stop to announce the customer to the peers. That means usually each customer has an IP range. And usually what you're seeing too is like the customers being attacked are running IEC servers, online gaming servers, porn websites and so on. So you can really profile the type of customers that are running these kind of systems. And most of them that know about the problem just have specific IP ranges that they receive from RIPE. So you can really go there and just stop announce them to the peers. So you black hole them. Nobody in the internet can reach them anymore because kind of the IP space they own isn't routed anymore on the internet. So again, that's easy. It's really still the easiest way. The problem is you kill the customer, no connectivity anymore. But it usually tend to depend on, you know, is the attack just making problems to the customer or to more customers or to your whole network. So depending on what's going on, this is one of the things you can do. Another approach for mitigation is to mark the roads, you announce to peers with a special community. And before that, you need to talk to your transit providers. That means the big ISPs you are usually customers from. And to tell them, if you see a route being announced in BGP with that community, just drop the traffic. So that also makes sense, because not only are you going to filter out the attack, but you will also protect your upstream, because your transit providers are already going to filter in their network. So it's going to make your transit lanes more safe. The other approach, which is sometimes nicer, but not as good as, you know, having a way to keep the customer up, is diversion. Basically, ACL is going to drop traffic, rate limits going to limit the traffic, the aggregating blocks going to make the customer unreachable. Diversion, you can, depending on the type of attack and system you have in place, reroute traffic to a box and then inject the traffic back into the network. The basic type of diversions that are BGP-based is usually called BGP triggering, and one of them just means that you're going to send all the traffic into null zero on a Cisco box or drop on a Juniper box. This is kind of a special interface on each box that is like the recycle bin on Windows or dev null on a Unix system. So you're just going to send the traffic into it and it's going to be dropped. This BGP triggering is really effective, because you just need a central place where you're going to say, okay, I want that route to be dropped, and every router at the edge is going to drop it. So the traffic is not even going to enter your network. That technique has been around for a few years now. The second one is SQL routing. You're going to tell each box that the next hop for any destination is going to be a special box where you're going to concentrate all the traffic. So that can be quite useful when you want to have a look at the traffic, because when you're using blackholing, traffic is going to be dropped, so you will never going to know, you know, what kind of traffic or what kind of attack it is. So the single approach, you're going to bring everything into one central point, like this kind of magnet approach. Every traffic is going to end there. Problem is, if it's really large attack, you know, the network close to the single is going to die. The other approach that was used long time ago, and there's also a tool around called Tunnelix, is to put the traffic you want to divert into GRE tunnels. The problem is, with GRE tunnels, it's quite easy to use in small bandwidth networks. Like, you have a few megs. When it gets bigger, you're going to start to have load impact in CPU of the routers, because GRE implies creating a new packet that encapsulates the original packet, and there's also the overhead of having a new IP header. So that was used some time ago, but not really anymore now, because the risks are just too high to kill the box when you configure GRE interfaces. And also, a lot of high-end devices don't even support GRE interfaces anymore, so you have just no chance to do something with it. And another approach that was used some years ago was policy-based routing. On each box where you know that something may be going on there, you had a special IP policy that said, if that for that IP address, just send the traffic to that nearest destination to have a look at it. The problem is IP policing or policy-based routing has also, like GRE, quite a large impact on the box itself. Then some guys came up with, you know, using reverse NATs, reverse proxies, whatever. That just doesn't scale. I mean, if you just have one link with two routers, it's going to work, but not even in a large core network, even in a large enterprise network. Some people, like with policy-based routing, said, yeah, you could use the WCCP. WCCP version 2 is the web caching coordination protocol. So you say, it's a lot of ISPs are using that, especially ADSL providers, to do transparent proxying. That means you don't have to configure a proxy in your browser, but when the traffic hits the router in front, that has WCCP configured, it's going to just forward the traffic to the proxy and bring it back in. So you could use the same approach to divert traffic when an attack is going on, but it usually only applies to HTTP traffic, and most of the attacks are not HTTP based. So anyway, it's not a great help. Another concept we came up, and I just had it to Sky this morning because Lance mentioned it yesterday during the Honeypot talk, is MPLS based diversion. That one was, we should only have presented that at NATO 28 in 2 weeks. Basically, when you have an MPLS enabled backbone, that means MPLS basically means you don't use layer 3 routing anymore. but each packet has a label in front, and the packets are layer 2 switched, so to say, but it's quicker, and usually it makes diverting the traffic much more easy, because you just need to mark the destination we want to filter, and you can divert the traffic in MPLS, VPN, up to a point where you can analyze it, change it, do whatever you want with it, and then bring it back in. And nobody can see it, because when the back when it's MPLS enabled, what you're going to see when you do a trace route, you won't see the hops in the middle. That means when you do a trace route, when you enter the network, you see the first hop of the MPLS edge, and the last hop when you leave the backbone again. But you won't see like if there are 5, 10, or 20 routes in between. You may just find out, like, by if you know the network, by looking at the delay, you could say, okay, 20 milliseconds means probably like that many kilometers or that many routes or whatever, but you can find out how many ops in the network. So what we have been doing in the lab is, when some customer is being attacked, you can just mark it with a special label, bring it to a point where you have a scrubber running, snort, whatever thing, like, not inline, what is the name, hogwash, whatever, you can play with the traffic and filter it. You can keep things out and you can bring it back in. Some vendors like Riverhead have a product that really does kind of cleaning. You bring the bad traffic in and it tries to bring or to send clean traffic out. So it's working to some extent, losing like, you know, sync cookies, changing UDP DNS requests, TCP based DNS requests, and these kind of things, playing kind of HTTP man-in-the-middle thing. And for some type of attacks, it's quite effective. So, and using MPLS and even a cheap Linux box with some geeky interface, you can really play with it, and it's working quite well. The good thing or the advantage of our GRE terms or so, you don't have any overhead. Just mark the packets, you bring them there, you bring them back in. The only thing you have to pay attention to to have like one or two boxes in your network that are close to your entry points. So you don't, if the traffic is or the attack is coming into London, you should avoid bringing the traffic to Milan and then bring it back to Paris because the customer is in Paris. So if you know your network, you can have like 2 or 3 points where you have this kind of scrubbers, bring the traffic there and then bring it back in, and usually the overhead you have or the bandwidth you're going to use on your own network is cheap, so it makes no difference. And nobody can really find out what the box is or what the box is doing because you cannot see it in the heart of the network. Okay, last thing, traceback. You need to find a way you should trace back the attack. The first step, or the first thing you're usually doing in the kind of DDoS process or DDoS fighting process is to try to protect the infrastructure and the customer by doing blackcoding, ACLs, wake committing, as I said just before. The next thing is to trace back. You usually need to talk to your major peers and transit providers and have them help you trace back the attacks and shut down the attack if it's only possible. So one of the approaches for traceback that has been used for quite some time is to use ACLs. The ACL approach is just to classify the type of attack and to find out on which interface the traffic is entering your box. So problem with that one is like it's really time consuming. You need to start at the edge, close to the customer, and then hop by hop go back up to your transit or peering points to find out, okay, where is it entering? So that's the approach that it's quite effective, but you know it's really, really time consuming. You probably need like half an hour to an hour, depending on the network size, just to find out some of the entry points. And if it's coming in everywhere, yeah, then it's already lost battle. The other one is using NetFlow, and that one's quite effective. Since most of your devices on the edge are going to send NetFlow calling data, you're going to see where you have your major flows or where you have the source and destination flows coming in or leaving your network. Keep in mind that NetFlow won't work in the core of the network if it's MPLS enabled, because you know packets won't hit layer 3, only layer 2. So NetFlow in the core only works if you have normal layer 3 and only an MPLS enabled backbone. Quite effective. Some issues. I'm going to come back to the issues later on. You have also a commercial vendor which is called Harbor that's doing some things. A product called PinkFlow. That's a nice GUI. It's basically what you can have as a GPL product like FlowScan or using Argos or whatever, but just you know nice appliance packed or whatever. So not bad at all. Then in the meantime, Cisco came out with a new feature called source tracking. It's basically doing the same things like the ACLs, it's just easier to do on each box. It's still, you know, you need to go to from the access layer, the edge, back to the transit and the peering points. You just activate the source tracking feature and you tell the box to watch that destination IP address, and it's going to tell you on which interface it enters the box. So basically the same thing as the ACL approach. Difference was that on some of the boxes, ACLs are killing the CPU because it's not happening in the ASICs, but it's happening in software and CPU. So they came up with source tracking and say like source tracking is not going to hit the CPU. So you have your first attack, you try source tracking, you kill your box. So it's getting fixed now, but if you're still running old iOSs and want to do source tracking, just pay attention, you can just kill your box by activating the feature. Another approach that we are using to trace back is the new zero interface counter. Usually what we're doing is like the first thing to do is to black hole for a few minutes at least to have the time to find out what's happening. As I said, when you black hole, you don't know where, because you black hole the whole network. So by looking using SNMP, for example, at null zero interface counters, you can find out on which box packets are being dropped. So that approach is not bad. And the other one is, next to looking at the null zero interface counters, also looking at the queues. Where do you have on which interface you have a lot of drops or resets, or if it's Ethernet, you know, lane collisions or whatever. So by putting the box over SNMP or getting into the box and using the show commands to have a look at the values, you can find out where it's coming in. So I think it's the cheapest way of doing it. You don't need any additional hardware, you just need to get to the box and have a look at it. What's the impact of all the attacks? What you've been seeing over the last few years, the agents are becoming much, much more powerful. The propagation speed is like close to light speed now. CKeepSlammer was still slow, and it's really getting faster. It's down from, I don't know, CodeRed, probably it took 6 hours to be, you know, at the top of the infection, so to say. CKeepSlammer was just a few hours, even a few minutes, depending on the content locations. So it's always nice on Saturday morning when you get cold and like, yeah, there's some things, strange things going on, it's UDP 1434, what's that? And propagation speed is really, really getting better. Routing stability. Some guys did some studies after CodeRed and the different CodeRed, you know, CodeRed 2, CodeBlue, whatever they were called, of the routing stability. And they have seen that the techniques that ISPs are usually using to protect the network may, in case of attack, attack the ISP itself. There's something called in BGP, which is called loop dampening. When you usually BGP, every time a route changes and it's announced from kind of end to end, you change a route in your network, the whole internet's going to know about it, so to say. So if you're playing with your network all the time, like up, down, up, down, up, down, it basically means that all the boxes on the internet have to relay the best paths to that network. Route dampening is every time such change is happening, marking the draw and saying, if it happens again in the next 5 minutes, I'm going to drop it for 15 minutes. Or for 30 minutes or 2 hours, depending on the policy you're going to use. So when a thing like CodeRed hit the internet, I mean, some of the boxes that were not that powerful started to flap the BGP sessions. So some ISPs disappeared, came back. And the effect was, well, it only happened 3 times, you're out for 2 hours. So it's really key that all the BGP information exchange is made safe so that when that routing stability still keeps up and doesn't die. The thing is, as long as it's on the transit or forwarding path of the box, usually the box survives. But some ISPs have the, depending on the architectures, it can be a bad or good idea to use, don't use default free routing in the core. That means you use BGP route information if the route is in BGP. If it's not in BGP, you look at your IGP, the internet gating protocol you're using, OSPF, IS, or whatever. And if not, you have a default route out. The problem was that with CodeRed, for example, it was scanning just ranges from 0.0.0 to 255 to 255 to 255 and so on. So for all the destinations that didn't exist, well, the packets hit that default gateway. And usually the default gateway was the box running BGP. You're dead. So, you know, default-free routing, I know it really depends on sync, but keep in mind, it's really like a magnet in the network when you have this kind of attack going on. The other discussion we had, and we had really kind of tough discussions internally with the network engineers, is how do you filter at large scale? You cannot easily filter transit networks, or you need to find, you know, the right balance between filtering and not filtering. It was always a discussion, you know, your backbone should be here to carry the traffic, even if it's a DDoS, it's still traffic, and the backbone is here to carry the traffic, versus the approach, you want to build a really large firewall like in China. So we really had, sometimes tough discussions to find, you know, what's the right balance of filtering, not filtering. And we came to the point of saying, since our core is MPLS enabled, we filter at the edge. Since nobody should talk to the core of the network directly, since everything is layer 2 switched, you just filter the IP space you have in the core, just filter it at the edge. Why should somebody, you know, talk to a box that's in the middle of my core, since you shouldn't even see it with stress route? So filtering at the edge, every traffic going to the core, and also changing the coloring of some packets for QoS usually makes your core safe against infrastructure attacks. But it basically means you need to have a structured address plan, not using like, I'm going to use that network, that IP, and just change it all the time. So make sure when you build a network or do some major changes, that the address scheme you're going to use in the core and at the edge still fits the concept. Otherwise, you really have no chance of filtering things. And you're going to understand that later on, that you cannot like put 200 ACLs, like each box itself, on the one line in ACL to filter it out. Latest state of attacks, I mentioned some of them like some years ago called RED and the variants, SQL Slammer. What you're seeing is, we are watching the network for quite some time now, and some of our major DDoS customers get DDoS once a day. Can be from the basic, you know, TCP SYN attack, just, you know, SYN flooding, still old, you know, ICMP flooding, some more advanced HTTPS based, you know, launching a lot of downloads from some sites and just killing sessions to use the buffer on the servers. All this kind of, like, that was, I think, one of the lines of the NAFTA attacks and so on. We really see a lot of them. And also things have changed from, like I said before, from really small large packets on the beginning, just, let's just eat up the bandwidth. I have a large botnet, you know. I can generate 2 or 3 gigs of, the attacks. It's kind of normal to see an attack of 2, 3, 4 gigs now. I mean, before it was like 10, 15 meg or 100 meg was already a lot. 2 or 3 weeks ago, we had one that was 2.5 or 3 gigs of bandwidth, which is really a lot, even for a large provider. So, and you had really like 250 or 350 bots behind them you have identified that were probably not spoofed, but it's really getting large. So the old attack bandwidth still works, usually kills the customer, but not the core of the network, because the core can usually, I mean, if you have designed a network to be able to fail over, if you lose some major links, your backbone should be able, under normal conditions, operations, survive any large packet-based attack. No, people started to send kind of special small packets, like all the special fields, and don't send it again. Don't send it to the customer's network, but just send it to the box, the access router or the CPE. CPE is the custom premises router sitting just near on his link, because the router deals in a completely different way with packets he receives than packets he forwards. So it's really the attacks are reshifting from the end system, the end user, to the core network. And also the propagation speed is really quite impressive. And I have the feeling that the guys writing the bots still don't have, you know, they still didn't spend the right time on optimizing propagation speed. There have been some changes, like in some latest bots we have seen, like GT botnets or others. They already have pretty fine ranges to scan, like cable networks, 24/8 in the US, some major cable providers or DSL providers in Europe. So they're already targeting the pieces they want to infect. And it's not just, you know, start from 4x0 to 4x255 and just count whatever you like. They already start to target it. And the computation speed is also like, if you have an infected box, you know, don't try 20 times, so go to the author, but try to come back, since it's just IP address is temporary and it's static to the sign, and it's really changing. Most also we see like that most of the network and routing protocols are quite stable, but when the attacks are really against some smaller ISPs, usually the BGP sessions start to drop, and then the nice BGP dampening that is usually saving your CPU when that changes, well, make you just black hole some of the destinations. Like with CKubeSlammer, the Asia Pacific region was probably down for a day on average on everything, but there was that much flapping that it was really black hole for most of the Saturday. Also, the other thing is the active bots and botnets. People are start or the communities and so on, and some big ISPs are really watching bots and botnets. Seeing a botnet with like 110k or 120k bots in it is just normal nowadays. 2 or 3 years ago, it was like, yeah, you had a small botnet, like 20, 30 boxes. Now it's so huge. Like I said before, you know, you don't need to spoof the source. No, I mean, nobody can filter it anyway. So that's really impressive. The trends, like I said on slide before already, is that really the attacks we are really seeing, and we are not the only ones. I mean, when I say we, it's like the ISP and attackers, seeing the attack shifting from end systems towards the core. Sync is really trying to kill things like ACL, queues, CPU, all the things that are really limited in the box, where that are really hardware limited and can easily change with just a patch. So this being targeted. Also, the board networks and communications are really improving. People are still using IRC and P2P, P2P networks to communicate because it's so easy. It's really easy, it's available, you have a lot of servers. I mean, who's going to look at all, I don't know, all the CASA traffic somewhere to see if there are some bot comments in it, you know, you just have a chance. So people came up with an ID called HoneyBotNet. Same concept as a HoneyBot, but you watch all the IRC P2P based communications, and when a box gets infected, you take a forensic walk, you take
the bot, you have a look, you know, to which IRC servers should it talk? Which are the keys in it to authenticate against the channels or the commands it's going to receive over a channel. And basically run that bot in a safe mode, like you really one-to-many. When the master agent is going to tell all its agents to launch an attack, you're going to know who is going to attack because you're going to have a full list of the IPs being attacked. So that's one of the ways of watching what's going on. And you just see, you know, you can just send a mail to the ISP. You're probably going to see an attack going to that range on your network, and just because the bot just gets some commands sent out. So the community came up with a mailing list called NSP Security, which is hosted by some guys from Vireo and managed by some guys from UNET, Cisco, and so on. It's really live data exchange between ISPs concerning attacks. The NSP security list is not invitation only, but it's you have a vetting. So if you're really active in that field, you just submit kind of your bio to the moderators, can send to list, and if people in the industry know you and trust you, and you're really like an ISP or telco, whatever, that has to deal with that on a daily basis, you're going to get to the list. And you get kind of all the useful infos about what's going on. Okay. Any question? Not now, okay. Let's have architecture. So, what architecture? Just have one slide on it. There are many, many different types of routers. So it's just a kind of an overview of how a router is built, and going to use that to compare a little bit like with normal PCs, Sun systems, being it Windows, Unix based, whatever, how they are built and how to do forensics on it, because it's not as easy as doing forensics on a normal system we are really used to. So, like with any system, you have at least a motherboard. we have a CPU, usually it's a RISC-based CPU, MIPS and Motorola, but it really depends on the systems. Everybody seems to think that the ROT is quite fast, or ROT CPU is quite fast. It's really, really slow. Your normal Intel PC with a 2 gig Itanium or 2 gig processor, it's like 10 or 20 times faster as a CPU from a router. Memory, a bus, internal bus, and I/O interfaces. The bus, depending on the hardware, it's usually PCI based, and the I/O interfaces are used to communicate with the line cards or the network interfaces where your lines are connected. This is really the basic things. Now, when you look at the recent or larger hardware, being the GSRs from Cisco or larger M-series from Juniper, I mean, it's really getting to a more complex system. It's using ways to distribute tasks between the main CPU that only takes care of running the system, just keep the system up, looking at the environment temperature, you know, is everything running, do I have power supplies up, all the line cards, because each line card has its own CPU now. There are the engines with the specific ASICs that have tasks to do. It's really not. Most of the real, like 90% of the operations that the box has to do, or 95%, like forwarding, running packets, is done in hardware. It's not software based anymore because software is just too slow. So the ASICs are really getting complex, and you can usually change a microcode in it, but it's not easy to change the ASICs. You cannot just patch them or change them, so usually you have to change like major things, being the line card or the engine. On the memory side, you have different types of memory, and there it really becomes critical when you get to 4 and 6, because most of the data you guys are going to see on routers is only on the router until you power it off. If you do power off, power on, like 90% of what you need to do 4 and 6 is gone. So one way to compensate that is making sure that you log as much as possible, but also without killing CPU, memory, or whatever. So, excuse me, the flash memory is more or less the next to the NVRAM, the only memory that's non-volatile, because it contains the iOS image that it's going to boot. That one is preserved. You're not going to reload or upload iOS every time you boot a box. The main memory, being it DRAM, SRAM, or SDRAM, depending on the hardware, is where that's the one that contains the running iOS once it's being deflated and running after the core on-self test. And it contains all the major things, routing tables, statistics, local logs, and it's divided into memory regions. Some part of memory is just for the processor, and I/O and I/O2 is basically used for communication between the interfaces and between the interface itself, and also between the interfaces and the main processor. The NVRAM is the second part of memory, being non-volatile, that contains the startup configuration. That's the place by default where the configuration lies. You can change it. There's a command called bootconfig, and you can tell it to use some other devices that are available in the box to boot the system. And the main thing that you can change, but usually you don't change it, it's not easy to change, is like the BIOS on the PC that you flash like once every 10 years. Is the boot ROM, that part contains the ROM on code. It's basically doing the power on self test of the system, and it's the part when all the tests are done that's going to start up iOS. So the boot process is quite easy. Boot ROM first, checking all the hardware, loading iOS. Once iOS is loaded, the first part is going to look at the configuration file, and then finish all the booting, configure the interfaces, run to the go through the startup configuration, and copy startup configuration into running configuration. At the engine level, that's more GSR. GSR is the gigabit switch router from Cisco. It's really the massive router that you use in the core of the network. You have different type of engines. Some of the engines are done for edge features. That means things you're going to put at the edge of the network where you're going to do usually NetFlow, QoS, and ACLs. You have the core engines. The core engines are there and are really optimized, to forward traffic as fast as possible. And the latest core engines can do speeds up to 10 gig a second. You will never ever be able to do 10 gig a second on a normal engine 0, 1 or 2 edge interface. So usually when you have different type of engines, you cannot easily change them because that's probably the most expensive part of the box. And depending on type of engines you have, you may have some features, you may not have some features. So depending on what you want to put, like NetFlow, ICLs or whatever else, you may not be able to do it in a simple way. There's also one thing that was not really well documented, and usually that you discover during an attack. For most of the engine types, there's a slow pass. So everybody was thinking, yeah, cool, I have an engine, whatever car, everything is done in the ASIC, so it's fast. It's just not true. So ACLs, depending on the type of ACLs you use, and that's going to be quite important, hit the CPU. So even if Cisco tells you it's hardware, depending if you just use a log keyword or use port information, it's going to go up the CPU. All the IP options, if you have a packet with IP options, it's going to be of the slow pass. So one of the attack, but we have not seen a lot of them, is just to send some packet fluids with IP options to a GSR and it blows up. Quite easy, tracing back, no way. So in the latest iOS release, there's an option you can drop or ignore the IP options. But the RFC says you should follow the IP options. So, you choose. ICMP, same thing, you send a lot of, that was also quite an easy attack against most of the routers. You send a lot of packets where you know it's going to have to generate ICMP response, like ICMP echo reply to a ping, to a normal echo request, and ICMP generating destination unreachable or whatever. So just by filling the box with that, and since it can be done in hardware because it has to generate a new packet, a new response, also was eating up all the CPU. So in the latest iOS, by default, I think it only generates an ICMP every 2 seconds, or not more than whatever in 2 seconds. The side effect of that is that sometimes when you transfer the ping a box, you see some peaks in the response time. It's not that the box is busy. It's just being rate limited, or they have rate limited the number of ICMP responses you're going to send. So when customer come and say, yeah, when I ping the box, ping or trace route times you're going to see are not reliable. Because first of all, ICMP is a low priority protocol on the box. And it's going to take care of it when it's done with the rest. So it's really in the low priority queue. So using ping or trace route to find out the response time of a network, it's just a broken way of doing it. Other things that are also hitting the slow pass are all the multicast traffic. So depending if you deliver multicast services or a multicast enabled backbone, well, you may have some issues. As soon as you have some multicast peers, tracing backwards coming from when you're being attacked is really not easy. You have also different type of queues. Everybody was just thinking, there's one queue, it's a FIFO queue, first in, first out. You get a packet, you look at it, you're done, you send it out. So you have really a lot of queues because you need, first of all, queues to do a quality of service. So at least you have between 6 and 9, depending on hardware, different queues. And there's one queue that you should usually use for voice of IP, which is called a LLQ, which is a low latency queue. So again, low latency queue, well, when the queue is full, you have to drop. If you can send a packet that's going to hit the low latency queue, it's going to eat a part of it. So you really have to pay attention. And I can only tell you one thing. At the edge, if the MPLS or if the core is MPLS enabled or whatever, filter to the core and recolor packets. And because you should be able to decide the priority you want to give packets in your network. Being at the edge, coming from transit links, but also from the edge, from the access customers.